basically what we're witnessing today is the success of a 35-year political and economic campaign to walk away from a serious commitment to using all arms of policy to promote full employment.
The most sustainable source of increases in wages growth is a labour market in which the demand for labour is in excess of the available supply of labour, so that, you know, the relative bargaining position of employees and employers is more evenly matched than it has been over at least the last decade.
Hello, everyone. This is not Catherine Murphy. It's Gareth Hutchins, political and economic correspondent for Guardian Australia, and this is a special economics edition of Australian Politics Live. For this podcast, my colleague Greg Jericho and I invited two distinguished economists on to talk about Australia's low wages growth. We're trying to get to the bottom of what's happening in the economy at the moment. When was the last time you had a pay rise? I feel like it's almost unheard of these days. But this isn't just a feeling I have or you might have. It's happening to everyone. And to discuss the problem, we got two economists on, Saul Eslake to talk about the macroeconomics and John Buchanan from Sydney University, who talked about the institutional arrangements in Australia. The combination of their perspectives was fascinating to listen to. Saul was dialing in from Tasmania, and you may hear his dog in the background expressing his own macroeconomic opinions. Saul, perhaps you could kick us off by explaining the macroeconomics of the situation. Why are wages growing so slowly?
At the highest level, wages are growing slowly in Australia, as in most other advanced economies, because the balance of power in negotiation over wages between employees and employers has changed in favour of employers and to the detriment of employees. Now, there are many interrelated causes of that shift in the balance of power between employees and employers. Some of them, and I imagine John will say more about this than I can, are the result of legislative changes to the arrangements under which wages are negotiated between employees or their unions on the one hand and companies or bosses on the other. And Australia is not unique in that regard. But there have also been some other economic forces, both short-term and long-term, that have influenced the relative bargaining strengths of employers and employees. In the first place, there have been long-term structural changes in the nature of employment, shifting away from goods-producing industries that have traditionally been dominated by men who are more likely to join unions, towards service-producing industries, which are more employers of women, who are less likely to join unions. And moreover, in private sector services, it's more difficult for industrial action to inflict pain on employers that encourages them to accede to at least some of workers' demands in the way that is more feasible in goods-producing industries, for example. In addition, we've seen increases in unemployment that have persisted for a long time, that have meant that workers have felt they face more competition from other people in their own economies, in addition to the heightened competition that they face from employees in other countries through increased international trade, outsourcing and offshoring. And although this is by no means new, employees also perceive that they face more competition from technology in the form of computers, robots, algorithms and the like. And all of this has led workers to feel that they are at greater risk if they push for very high wage increases, and it's made them less likely to do so. And finally, productivity growth has been lower in most advanced economies, including Australia, since 2005 than it had been over the previous decade. In the long run, economic theory suggests that wage gains are closely related to productivity growth. So to sum up, it's a combination of legal, long-term structural, shorter-term economic and other factors that I think explain low wages growth in Australia, as in other advanced economies over recent years.
John, just quickly, you've recently argued that the political class may be suddenly in a low-level panic about stagnating wages, but the irony is that we're simply witnessing the outcome of policies that have long been advocated. And you've also argued that Australia's system of industrial tribunals and awards are now, after decades of cumulative so-called reforms, working to entrench wage equality rather than reduce it. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Basically, what we're witnessing today is the success of a 35-year political and economic campaign to walk away from a serious commitment to using all arms of policy to promote full employment. And when you have no institution taking full or cluster of institutions promoting that outcome, you get the kind of situation we've got. So where you have high levels or higher levels of unemployment and particularly high levels of underemployment, you basically have an excess supply of labour relative to labour demand, and that limits workers' bargaining power. In the past, Australia's been able to protect living standards even in situations like that. From the turn of the 20th century right through to the 1980s, there was a notion that the gains of economic growth should be widely shared. That philosophy was achieved by the development of a system which, in its essence, held that those workers who were strong enough to exercise considerable bargaining power could test out how far employers could go in granting decent wage increases. They would then set a community norm that was recognised by industrial tribunals, and those gains were then shared through the workforce at large through adjustments to awards. So that meant that the gains of the strong could be shared with the those who are weak. There's been a bipartisan commitment since the late 1980s to transform that institutional environment and basically quarantine the gains of the strong. And simultaneously, with changes in, with the rise of chronic unemployment and underemployment, employers have actually changed the whole nature of work. It's not just the industry and occupational nature of change, it's the form of employment itself. So in the early 1980s, the great bulk of the workforce were full permanent employees. Full-time permanent employees are now about 50% of the workforce. So under those conditions, there's a big chunk of workers who have very little power. And what's happened, particularly since the reforms to the Industrial Relations Act brought through by the Keating government and then entrenched by the Howard government, that institutional arrangement that used to share the gains of the strong with the weak has been eradicated. And we've locked in a situation now where even if people do want to advance their cause and share the gains, they're prohibited from doing so.
One of the things we're often hearing from the Prime Minister and the Treasurer and others is that actually nothing's changed, that nothing's broken, that the laws of demand and supply still hold. And one of the key aspects of that relationship is the link between wages and unemployment, which held that when unemployment rate goes down, then wages growth would go up. But we seem that since about the end of 2014, at least, that relationship has completely broken down. Do either of you believe that we're going to ever go back to a similar relationship, or has there been a structural shift in that sense?
I find myself agreeing up to a point, not only with the Prime Minister, but also with the Governor of the Reserve Bank in the speech he gave, where he said the laws of supply and demand haven't been repealed as far as the labour market's concerned. One of the reasons why wage growth has been so weak around the advanced world, not just in Australia over the last decade or so, is that unemployment has been well in excess of what has come to be regarded as the full employment level in so many countries. And in Australia, the conventional unemployment rate's still 5.5%. And as John mentioned, there's a considerable amount of so-called underemployment on top of that that the conventional unemployment rate doesn't fully capture. But if we look at some other advanced economies, in the four largest advanced economies, the US, Japan, Germany, and the UK, the unemployment rate has has for between 6 and 24 months been below each of those four countries' conventional definitions of full employment. And in the US in particular, where the unemployment rate has been below 5% in all but three of the last 24 months, we are actually now beginning to see more convincing evidence of wages growth beginning to accelerate. Less well noted here in Australia, but nonetheless, I think important, is that in Germany, where the unemployment rate has been below 4% for the last 12 months, the biggest union, IG Metall, has just negotiated increases working out to an annualized pace of 3.5% per annum over the next few years, although it's been talked about in the press in terms of the headline increase of 4.6%. And both of those are signs that in a sufficiently tight labor market, wages growth will eventually accelerate. I think what might also have been happening for some of the other longer-term reasons that I mentioned before, such as changes in the structure of employment as between industries, the gender mix of employment, as well as some of the legislative changes to the way in which labour markets and wage bargaining operate, have lowered what economists call the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, or sometimes less, more brutally, the natural rate of unemployment. What that means is that perhaps the unemployment rate has to be lower for a longer period than, for example, in the 80s and 90s before wages growth begins to accelerate. But nonetheless, I think the evidence from what is admittedly a small number of countries where the unemployment rate is now getting close to or below historical full employment levels, wages growth does pick up and push up. So in my view, while I'm not saying that the only thing that can be done to lift wages growth is to push for fuller employment than we've had, what I would say is that the most sustainable source of increases in wages growth is a labour market in which the demand for labour is at least in excess of the available supply of labour, so that, you know, the relative bargaining position of employees and employers is more evenly matched than it has been over at least the last decade.
Look, I suppose I'd take a little bit of issue with that. I find the comments of the Treasurer and the Prime Minister pretty unhelpful. No one's actually ever said that the laws of supply and demand have been repealed. I mean, I think what these people are displaying is an absolute poverty of understanding of how advanced industrialised economies work. Sure, market conditions set the upper limits and the lower limits within which wages can be set. You know, the lower bound is set by what the Reserve Army of Labour will take, and that's pretty low, and the upper limit's set by the governing rate of profit. But what rates prevail ultimately are determined by the institutional arrangements that prevail in a society. And you might get a bit of a dead cack bounce as, you know, conditions tighten a bit. But, you know, IG Metall and its kind of institutional arrangements are not replicated in most countries. IG Metall is a fantastic union. I mean, it sets working time norms and wage norms. It's set them for decades. If you took IG Metall out of the German economy, you would not be getting wage increases of that form going as broadly as they have been. So to say it's all about supply and demand is just continuing the 30-year dribble we've had served up to us on how an economy works. It's not just simply about supply and demand. It's the overall context within which supply and demand is functioning. And, you know, is it one where there's a policy mix committed to full employment? And secondly, what institutional arrangements are in place to ensure a fair distribution of the gains of growth?
On the institutional aspect, what role do you think governments have to play? At the public sector level, we've had the recent announcement from the Public Service Commission to limit enterprise bargaining agreement growth to 2% per annum. Is that actually providing a bit of a signal to the private sector that there's actually a bit of a limit to wage growth, and that is actually working against what the Treasurer, the Reserve Bank Governor are actually arguing for in wanting a bit more wage growth?
This wasn't a community norm. This is what's known as a state-led wages cap. And when you have that kind of restraint on the capacity of people to reach wage increases, that flattens the capacity of the workforce to actually ensure that their gains keep pace with productivity movements and price movements. So these kind of political determinants are very important. Historically in Australia, it was strong blue-collar unions which used to set the wage norms. Over the course of the 1980s, it was strong unions with women workers, teachers and nurses who were setting wage norms. But New South Wales Treasury set the pattern, which other governments have replicated, of making sure that those unions, which are predominantly women, are held in check.
Right. And Saul, If you agree with Phil Lowe, the governor of the RBA, that the laws of supply and demand haven't broken, they may have stretched, it will take longer for wages to grow once there's been a fall in unemployment. And when wages do start growing, they won't return to the levels that they once did. So they'll be 2% rather than, say, 4%. What will that mean for the average worker in Australia?
Well, if that's right, then the inevitable corollary is that household incomes will grow at a slower rate over the longer term than they have done over extended periods in the past when unemployment has been lower than it is today. But while my argument certainly is that unemployment will probably need to be lower for longer than it has been in previous cycles before wages growth starts to accelerate, it's not my view that when it does start to accelerate, 2% growth in wages will be seen as the norm. I mean, after all, given that the Reserve Bank is targeting an inflation rate averaging 2.5% over the cycle, that would imply real wages falling over the longer term in circumstances where you have reasonably full employment. And I don't think that that's likely. If I could go back to the question you put to John, though, about the role of the public sector in its negotiations with its own employees, I think the premise in your question was right, that does serve as a signal to private sector employers as well. And one of the things that governments could do if they were serious about wanting to engineer a faster rate of wages growth in present circumstances is to take a different view of negotiations with their own employees. Now, I want to say this very carefully. I'm not at all supporting and don't want to be interpreted as supporting the idea that public sector employees should all of a sudden get a wage increase of 5 or 6%, for example. But if it was to be 3, then I don't think that that would be a serious problem. In the same way, I think the government could play a different role in supporting a higher wage increase at the annual minimum wage hearings held by the Fair Work Commission, rather than simply lining up with whatever the employer associations represent. The other point I just sort of want to go back to for a minute is the change in Australia's own industrial relations arrangements over the last 30 years. I wouldn't dispute John's description of the historical facts there, but I would want to observe that the system that we had up until the 1980s, particularly in its last 15 years or so, did mean that the high wage increases obtained by unions who were able to extract them from profitable employers, which were then passed on to employees in other sectors of the economy where profitability or productivity growth wasn't as high, did condemn us to persistently higher inflation and or unemployment than other countries with different systems often inherited. While we had a system of high tariff protection, it was to some extent possible to insulate less competitive firms and employees from the effects of that. But as soon as we started dismantling tariff protection, which I think was a good thing to do on other grounds, then that part began to break down. I think the desire to ensure that all employees share in national prosperity is a very desirable and attainable goal. But in my view, it is much more sustainably attained through the tax system rather than through the wage system. And it would be a fair criticism to say that the tax system hasn't really tried to achieve that objective in the last 30 years. And I would much favour attention being given to the role the tax system can and should play in that regard, rather than expecting the wage system to fulfil that purpose.
I think that's a very dangerous road to go down. If you let wage structures change, they're very hard to shift back. And there's got to be a reference point for the setting of living standards in a society. And throughout most of the 20th century, Australia did a really good job in having a fully transparent process by which all parties could contribute to the formation of wages policy. If you hand over the maintenance of living standards to Parliament, it becomes a plaything in a political football. And I think that's something that people have lost sight of. And we're now living with the consequences of a wages system which has entrenched a growing low-wage sector. So when we're talking about the situation we're in, we shouldn't be calling on the government to have more tax cuts or more income support systems. We should be looking very long and hard at what kind of structure of an economy are we creating. And wages policy can be used as a discipline on tardy employers. And by allowing wages to drift down at the bottom end of the labour market, you're basically encouraging laggards to limp on. The situation in the 80s was not Australia being a basket case. In fact, the centralised wages system was used very effectively as a tool of macroeconomic management. It actually engineered the shift in factor shares. And you can have a coordinated wages policy which can complement ongoing economic renewal, as has been shown in all sorts of countries. The most celebrated one at the moment is, you know, Denmark, but at the time it was Sweden. And I think it's very important that we keep our eyes on wages and we don't say it's all the fault of the government because there aren't enough tax cuts.
And just following on from that, with the sense that Australia is now very much an open economy, the government's big ticket item that it's putting forward to help wages growth is a company tax cut. And this is something that we've seen the American government as well been trumpeting as leading to wage growth. What are your views on the efficacy of this, that as a policy, in terms of driving wages growth?
Well, there is a theoretical case that cutting the company tax rate will boost the after-tax return to investment, which will lead to more investment, which by boosting the capital to labour ratio will lead to higher productivity, which in turn will ultimately lead to higher real wages. That's a theoretical proposition that has widespread but by no means universal support among economists. However, in the Australian context in particular, there are a number of flaws in it. Very hard to find much empirical evidence that supports that theory working out in practice. And the best example, I think, in this context is Canada's experience, Canada being the economy that in most respects is more like Australia's than any other in the world. Since 2000, the Canadians have cut their corporate tax rate from 42% to about 26%, whereas apart from the fall that happened after the Ralph report in 2000, Australia's company tax rate has been steady at 30% over that interval. Business investment has increased more as a percentage of GDP in Australia over the last 16 years than it has in Canada, despite the fact that we've had no corporate tax cuts, and they've had some quite big ones, and wages have increased by about 20% more over the last 16 years in Australia than in Canada, despite the fact that, again, they cut corporate taxes and we didn't. So the empirical evidence to support the proposition that the government and others are putting actually isn't all that strong.
Yeah, look, I support what Sol's saying there. I mean, you've also just got to look at what US companies have done with their latest tax cuts and the way they've talked about them. The gains are quite frankly trivial. And when you've got mainstream papers like the New York Times, you know, having a go at Walmart for having a marketing drive as opposed to a substantive shift in factor shares, you know there's a problem.
Right. Well, in order to wrap up, I think we should let listeners know how you think this situation in Australia will unfold over the next couple of years. I think it would be a fair summation of what Treasurer Scott Morrison has been saying, to say that wages will eventually rise. It's just taking a long time, so don't worry too much about it. Meanwhile, here are some company tax cuts that could speed things along. But given what we've heard today, John, do you think that there needs to be an overhaul, if that's not too strong a word, of the industrial relations system in order to get things going properly? Or do you think, like, unless we're just going to have more of the same and wages will eventually grow and that will be that?
I'm my first training's in history before I did economics, so I'm very reluctant to make forecasts. But what I do like to think of is in terms of scenarios. And I think Australia's at a very interesting moment. It's kind of like China was in the early 1960s after the great tragedy of the Great Leap Forward. You may remember that it's now recognised that the Chinese Communist Party, through its economic policies, ended up killing 34 million people through the Great Leap Forward. How do you respond to that? Well, there was a reform group which basically said, we've got to change direction, we've got to grow more food. But then Mao came back and said, no, the problem is we didn't implement the policies properly. We've got to let the policies have more time to run. And he unleashed the Cultural Revolution. That's the kind of moment we're here in Australia at the moment. You hear people like Scott Morrison and the Reserve Bank Treasurer saying, look, we've got the policies right for the last 30 years. We just need a little bit more time for it all to come together. Well, it didn't work in China in the 60s and the 70s, and it won't work in Australia now, where something's not delivering so badly after having 30 years of trying to get it right. You've got to think differently. And that's the moment we're at. You're seeing a rise in industrial disputes in some areas. You know, I'm living in Sydney. We had a very significant dispute brewing in rail. I think as more people are suffering, you're probably going to see a return to militancy. How effective that will be is an open question. So on current settings, you know, if we stay on track for the kind of Reaganite, Thatcherite policy mix that's now entrenched in our wages system, we'll just see more of the same with, you know, people at the top clearly getting, you know, there'll be pockets of the labour market that do really well. So there will always be some people who get good money. But from an economy-wide perspective, if this policy mix stays in place, we will see more of the same. But it's an open question and things can turn quickly. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why the World Bank and the IMF are more guarded these days in calling for hardline deregulatory policies in the labour market. They've seen what happened in places like Venezuela. They've seen what happens in places like Argentina if you push those lines too hard. And they're now talking for a change in policy. If other policymakers start to think that way, we could see a shift. But at the moment, that's not happening.
Well, I do to some extent buy the arguments that have been put by the government that wages growth will accelerate once unemployment has been low enough for long enough, and we are not at that point yet, nor are we likely to be in the next 12 months or so. I favour policies that helped reduce unemployment and underemployment more quickly than is forecast by the Reserve Bank or the Treasury. But I do think that we will see an acceleration in wages growth when the unemployment rate gets lower than it currently is. And I think the evidence from other countries where unemployment is below the definition of full employment give me some heart in that regard. In the meantime, however, what I'd also say is that there are things government could do to accelerate wages growth. I mentioned before both the attitude it takes to bargaining with its own employees, but importantly also the attitude it takes to the minimum wage case, where they could be more supportive of bigger increases than they have been in the past. I also think there is room for reconsideration of some aspects of the industrial or the legislative framework within which wage bargaining is conducted. I would not want to see a return to the kinds of industrial militancy that we saw from the late 1960s until the early 1980s, the kind of wildcat strikes in essential services like the railways. But on the other hand, I think there is some legitimate case for revisiting provisions in the Fair Work Act that allow employers to cancel enterprise bargains and revert to awards at much lower pay. There may be room for other changes that are designed to alter the balance of bargaining power between employers and employees that could be considered in this environment. I think that's worth having a conversation about.
Right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Hope listeners enjoyed that. It's a very rich discussion. And we had a Tasmanian dog in the background for free, applauding some of the things you were saying, Saul. So thank you for that.
That's all right. His name's Barnaby, so take it with what you will.
That was Saul Eslake and John Buchanan. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. If you're interested in the topic of wages growth, we've got a series of articles and videos on the website that go into it in further depth. Hope you enjoy them. Thanks for listening.